Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we'll check in on the situation in Egypt and the region with Fawaz Jerjes, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics and author most recently of Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment. Following the recent attack by Islamist militants in the Sinai, the subsequent airstrikes by the Egyptian military, and the power move by Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, we want to understand better what's going on there and whether this is a big test for Egypt's new democracy and its commitment to peace with Israel. Hi, Fawaz. Welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Remind us exactly what happened in the Sinai last week and the reaction from both the Israeli and Egyptian governments.
Well, it was a major shock to the Egyptian political class and the military in particular. The attack in Sinai on a military installation, 17 Egyptian soldiers were butchered in cold blood, several were injured, a major failure on the part of the Egyptian military. And what the new Egyptian president did, Mohamed Morsi, he basically sacked the security chief, and a few days ago he sacked the defense minister, General Tantawi, and his second-in-command, Kofi Annan. So what Mohamed Morsi did, the new elected Egyptian president, who basically is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, he basically used the attack in Sinai as a justification to really bring about the beginning, I would argue, of a historical shift in the balance of power between the civilian leadership and the military leadership. As you know, Brian, the military in Egypt for the last 60 years ruled Egypt single-handedly. The balance of power for the last 60 years was in the military's hand. For the first time in 60 years, an elected civilian leader not only holds the security and military apparatus responsible for the security failure in Sinai, but he basically makes a major move to bring about, to redress the balance between civilians and the military as an institution.
Just to be clear on one thing, you said Kofi Annan a minute ago. Did you mean the former UN Secretary General?
No. I meant the new Egyptian President, Mohamed Morsi, and I said he sacked the Defense Minister, Tantawi, and his second-in-command, Sami Annan, which has the same last name as Kofi Annan.
Sami Annan.
He was the chief of staff for the Egyptian military before he was sacked by Morsi.
So Morsi is challenging the dominance of the military. Morsi is also, as you know, a former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. Is this also seen as a test of how he will deal with radical Islamists coming from, you know, this Islamist background himself?
I think this is a very important question. I think many Egyptians and many observers overseas underestimated the will and the ability of Morsi to really move against the militants. He made it very clear that he will not tolerate any particular insecurity breach of Egyptian territories. And what the Egyptian military has done in the last few days since the attacks against, the military installation, is to prove that Mohamed Morsi will act as the president of all Egyptians and will not tolerate any militant acts by Islamists. As you know, the Egyptian military now is trying to shut down all the, AIF smugglings in Sinai. And they have also shut down the border crossing between Gaza and Egypt, that is the Rafah crossing. What Mohamed Morsi is trying to do is to send multiple messages to Egyptians and the international community, is that the security of Egypt is sacred, its obligations, diplomatic and security obligations, will be respected, and that the security of Egypt is organically linked to security on its borders as well. And that's exactly what the United States wanted to hear from Morsi and the new elected leadership in Egypt.
And, of course, this happening on the border of Egypt and Gaza, obviously a volatile area, it was the first Egyptian military strike in Sinai since Egypt's 1973 war with Israel. Israel says military groups in Gaza joined forces with Islamists operating in Sinai, but Egypt's state news agency says the militants were only from Gaza and came into Egypt through underground tunnels. Is it clear which one it is, and does it matter?
No, Brian, no one really knows the identity of the perpetrators of the crimes. This is not the first attack on Egyptian soldiers, as you know. There have been several attacks on Egyptian security forces and also on Israeli civilians and police. Just for your listeners, Sinai has become one of the most, you might say, neglected and insecure areas in Egypt, in particular in the last 20 years. Poverty in Sinai is almost over 50%. Most of the population in Sinai, which is Bedouins, it's a Bedouin tribe, one of the most ancient and proud communities in Egypt and the region, believe that the Mubarak regime neglected the area. So what you have, the only economy that exists in Sinai is what I call the underground economy, that is basically smuggling goods and services and fuel and arms to Gaza, which is besieged by Israel. Also, illegal immigration from Africa and other places to Israel and Europe, and criminality. Sinai, in particular in the last 10 years, has become very attractive to jihadis, to fortune seekers, and criminals. And in particular, since the ouster of the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, lawlessness has spread to many parts of Egypt, particularly Sinai. So you have many characters, you have many criminals, you have many jihadis in Sinai, and the attack against the military installation in Sinai really was a wake-up call for the Egyptian military and for the Egyptian political class. And that's why now the new president in Egypt, is trying to find ways and means to deal with the situation in Sinai, because you cannot just deal with it in a very, you might say, short-term security situation. You have to deal with the economic situation, with the neglect and abuse that many Bedouins in Sinai feel. And you also have to bring about a new economy, because since in the last 20 years, tens of billions of dollars have been invested in Sinai. I mean, many Americans know about Sharm el-Sheikh, one of the most beautiful, you might say, resort areas in the world. Yet, most of the money went to outsiders as opposed to the local economy in Sinai. They went to crony capitalists. There's a great deal of corruption. So the local economy in Sinai has not benefited. And that's why what the new leadership in Egypt need to do is to really find ways and means to bring about an economy that's not based on criminality, on illegal immigrants, and also it is not really based on smuggling goods and services and arms to Gaza.
That's really interesting about some of the underlying tensions and root causes here, this disenfranchisement of the local population with outsiders getting the jobs through corruption in a tourist area, a strong underground economy developing as a result, illegal trading with Gaza, food and arms, which creates the kind of lawlessness that makes Sinai attractive for criminals and, I guess, jihadis. And you wrote that it's ironic that Hamas is being blamed for this attack. Where does Hamas fit in?
You know, truly, Brian, for your listeners, Hamas has been blamed for basically providing the context and for what has happened in Sinai. The reality is the jihadis, the militants, the extremists, we think they are, who basically perpetrated the crimes against Egyptian soldiers and other crimes, are basically have taken Hamas, have blamed Hamas for selling out. They believe that Hamas has sold out, in particular when it comes to armed resistance. There have been many clashes, armed clashes, between Hamas and the militant jihadis in Gaza itself. Few people realize that these jihadis are as opposed to Hamas as they are to the Egyptian military, because they believe Hamas is no longer a resistance movement. But at the end of the day, Brian, Hamas is paying for the attacks that have taken place against Egyptian soldiers. Hamas is being blamed by some Egyptian security forces and also by Israeli security forces. Here is the big point I want to really make, Brian. What has happened in the last week or so really shows very clearly the fierce urgency of a peace settlement between Palestinians and Israelis. You not only have to deal with the local economy in Sinai, you have to put an end to the shedding of Jewish and Palestinian blood. You have to bring about a settlement whereby two state solutions are established, security for Israel and justice for the Palestinians. And this is really what the big question, the big lesson that comes out of the Sinai clashes, because sealing off Sinai from Gaza, because Gaza and Sinai border one another, carrying out military strikes against militants will not address the structural and long-term challenge that exists between Palestinians and Israelis. I believe that Hamas has undergone major changes in the last 10 years or so, and I do hope that out of this particular turmoil comes a political horizon, a political vision. But, of course, this has to wait for the American elections and hopefully for the new American president, hopefully a second term for President Obama, will be able to convince both Palestinians and Israelis of the need to settle their clashes and establish a permanent peace settlement.
Fawaz Rajesh, author of Obama and the Middle East. And just one other thing before you go. I wonder if you would give us one thought about Syria, where things continue to unfold at a rapid pace. We even had the Syrian official who defected to Jordan last week with his statement that only 30% of the country is still under Assad's rule, and that the government there really is collapsing. Do you think the situations in Syria and Egypt affect each other?
Well, to a certain extent, of course, Brian, we teach our students is that everything is interconnected and linked in the Middle East. But what you have in Syria now is all-out civil war. The reality is Syria has reached a point of no return. Both the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, and the opposition are basically fighting to the bitter end. And I don't see really, Brian, despite all the nonsense that I hear, I don't see the beginning of the end in Syria. In fact, I would argue no one knows how long Assad will survive in power. The reality is we don't know the psychological mindset of Assad, of his brother, Maher al-Assad, who is leading the special forces, of the security apparatus. No one knows what's happening within the security apparatus itself. We know certain things. We know that Assad's forces are overextended and strained. We know that he has lost a big chunk of territory. We know that the armed opposition has become much more effective, much more potent, much more skilled and armed. But one thing is very clear, I would argue, that far from his days being numbered, in fact, I would argue the big question that many of us need to answer is why the Syrian regime has proved to be much more resilient than the received wisdom has it. Because, as you know, the Obama administration has been saying Assad's days are numbered for the last, 1 year or so. Mm-hmm. Yet it has shown itself to be much more resilient, and that's the question that we need to answer, and that's the question all the Syrians will show in the next few months and next few years. But for now, more bloodshed, more escalation, more fighting in Syria.
Do you think they would use the chemical weapons that they presumably have?
I really don't know, Brian. I mean, I think if you had asked me a few months ago, would President Assad use his jet fighters against civilian populations, I would have said I doubt it very much. If you asked me a few months ago, would some of the armed opposition, commit atrocities against captured Syrian soldiers, I would have said, of course not. This is a revolution about democracy and about inclusiveness. I think so much bloodshed has taken place in Syria. I think so many brutalities have taken place. And also what's really very complex about the Syrian crisis, this is no longer a conflict between the Assad regime on the one hand and the opposition. Syria has become a war by proxy. You're asking me about Syria's chemical weapons. Syria now has become a battlefield for Iran, which is trying to develop nuclear weapons, and for Saudi Arabia and Turkey on the other hand. So it has become now a theater for regional conflicts, Not to mention that both the United States and Russia are basically waging a war by proxy in Syria itself. A very complex, very difficult conflict, truly, Brian. No one knows how long this particular conflict will take and what will be the consequences on Syria, inside Syria, and on its neighbors as well, and what will the chemical and biological weapons that exist in Syria, what their use, their function, what if Syria's chemical weapons fall into the wrong hand?
Yes.
This is the most difficult and dangerous questions that few people know really answers to.
Fawaz Jurjes, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics and author of Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment. Thank you so much. We really appreciate all your insight. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we will spend the last few minutes of our program today on this 100th anniversary of her birth, asking, how did Julia Child affect your kitchen? Hey, this is not, you know, Rachel Ray. These recipes are complicated. 212-433-WNYC if you want to answer the question, how did Julia Child affect your kitchen?